on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Gordon Caldas, 94 years old. He lives now at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, but he grew up in Thief River Falls, Minnesota, where he helped the Prowlers of Thief River Falls High School to a Hoosiers-like basketball season in 1938. Undefeated, 27-0, state champions with a nail-biter of a 31-29 victory over the Big City Boys from Minneapolis North. See if you can spot Gordon in the photo of that championship team that I have up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or in his story at hometownheroesradio.com. The team that he was on in World War II was called the U.S. Navy, and as a PT boat commander in the Pacific, PT 522 to be exact, he carried a good deal of responsibility. Before the break, Gordon shared that he got used to combat, but can you give us some examples of those moments that you can never really get used to, where you had to react in an instant and do something that might make the difference between life and death?
One of the first patrols in Leyte, we had to travel from the east side of Leyte all the way down to the end of the island and go around the island and then back up on the west side of Leyte Island. What our commanders did, the plan was two boats together and up the whole entire west coast of Leyte. They stationed two boats in intervals of 2 or 3 miles apart the entire length of Leyte Island, and you were in that zone. Your job was to travel along at slow speed along the coast, close in, and cover those several miles. And then there was another zone of PT boats and so on the whole length. And we patrolled at idling speed that whole night in anticipating reinforcements that were coming in with the Japanese in a whole row of barges filled with personnel and, of course, ammunition and supplies. But there could be 5, 6, 7, 8 big barges with our radar, which, of course, was a saving grace for us. It shows a number of pips, small pips. These are vessels, and of course those rays bounce back, and they show on the screen, and they show you a pip that relates to the size of the vessel. We would pick those up. The radar man was down below in the cockpit calling to me and to the executive officer who was on the wheel. As the commander, I have a microphone in my left hand, microphone in my right hand. The one on the left microphone is to my crew. In my microphone in my right hand, that microphone is a second boat. So you're in command of both boats. My order to the second boat is to be close to our rear. We'll take a swing all the way around to the head of the Japanese barges. When you get to the head of it, take a left and proceed along the whole line of barges with your broadside and close together. And when you hit the head barge, give the orders to fire at will. So both boats with their broadsides would proceed slowly along that whole row of barges and demolish just as many as we can. They were packed with personnel and supplies, and our job was to destroy them all.
And that's one thing, but there were people out there that wanted to destroy you, too. And the sense I've gotten from talking to PT boat crewmen over the years is that there aren't necessarily a whole lot of places to hide on a PT boat if the enemy is shooting at you.
One thing that you kind of grin at, you know, the PT boats were made of plywood and two layers of plywood. So there's no protection. And I didn't mention that, but when you hit the head of the barge traffic, the personnel within those barges are firing at you. Fortunately, they're mostly rifles. The Japanese soldiers had rifles. And of course, with our armament, when you consider the broadside power that those two boats had, was really something. One thing that I used to have to do is always watch after I gave the order to fire at will is when the enemy starts shooting at you, you have a tendency to duck sometimes. You'd see our guns going up in the air. I'd have to yell, you know, lower your barrels, and they'd come right down and get on target. Most of the time, we'd demolish them. I can recall another instance where we had a surprise. This was a later combat. We discovered on the radar, we're hitting a long line of barges, but then there were three larger boats about the size of our PT boats, and they were surrounding and protecting the barges. So we were alerted that obviously they had some protection. When we came around to the head of the procession and straightened out, well, here was what we later found out were three Japanese PT boats, and one was at the head. When I gave the order to fire, our two boats blew that PT boat right out. We nailed that PT boat and then started demolishing all of the barges. There were the two PT boats towards the end, and then, of course, when we got to that point, we hit the second PT boat, and it took off. It started running. We chased that second PT boat. I'm confident it did not have radar. We had radar, and of course, our radar was right on it. And so we chased it, ran it down, and sunk it. So we got two out of the three PT boats, and I think virtually all of the barges. We think those were the only Jap PT boats that any of us ran into. Another instance, there were four boats at dawn, two sets of PT boats. We joined together down at the southernmost point. We went around the island, and at dawn, we pulled up in close to the shore, had deep water, to wait for our air cover. Because suicide planes at that point in the Battle of Leyte, the Japanese were really shooting their wad. Things weren't going well with them, and they converted to the suicide planes rather than the fighters. Same planes, but from a standpoint of accuracy, they decided instead of bombing, they were using their plane as a bomb. And, of course, they were going against the big ships. They go to any size, even PT boats. But at any rate, this dawn, we pulled in to wait for our air cover. And before our air cover came, we had pulled in while we killed our engines, and we were still in the cockpit. I had the gunners still in their seats. You had to remain alert all the time. We had one, two, three, four boats. Suddenly, while we heard this plane from a distance coming from the east, we heard the engine, and finally we spotted it, and it was a good-sized cove. This plane had watched us, and it was in the sun, and he dropped down over the trees, dropped down on the bay. We saw him just as he dropped down. Well, fortunately for us, he was coming across the bay, and he was already firing. He was right on top of the water, and he was so close to the top of the water, I think he was afraid that he was going to catch his wing in the water and, of course, spin him out. So he had committed himself. Well, what had happened, when he got down on the water, he was already firing his machine guns, but he was just off. His machine guns were going across probably about 20 or 30 feet beyond the bow. He'd misjudged it, and he couldn't, he didn't dare straighten out, but he was missing us, and just barely. All of our gunners were in position, and the 40-millimeter crew, see, the 40-millimeters, they have two seats. It rotates 360 degrees, two seats. One's a pointer, one's a trainer. One of them is horizontal, one is vertical. And those two guys, they've got to zero in to hit the point, hit the target. Well, they were coming around. They shot one shot. They were short. Shot a second shot. They hadn't reached it. The third shot, they hit the suicide straight on and blew it. In the meantime, before that, his machine guns were going across the bow. But with the third shot, They blew it. And the only thing left floating of the plane was his boot and a map. Well, of course, we started our engines. So we went out and we picked up the map and the boot. And the map showed the strip, airstrip they came from. So we took his boot and the map, of course, took that back to base. That was a suicide plane. That was the most personal one we had, but we had some others, too.
I don't want to be melodramatic, but what would have happened if those guys on that 40-millimeter weren't quite that accurate?
Well, we could have been lucky, because what I thought was, and I was just watching him, if he'd have come back, you know, I think he might have hit his wing, and he might have been short of us. He might have, you know, been able to turn more towards us. I concluded that he just didn't dare. And then, of course, the third shot got him.
But if you guys didn't get him, whether he would have gotten your boat or not, he probably would have hit something. And so you guys probably saved some lives by taking him out, not to mention the, you know, the intelligence value of finding out where they were coming from with that map.
Conceivably, you know, if he could have slanted just a little bit, he would have caught us, at least on the bow, you know. And, of course, 3,000 gallons. We're standing on 3,000 gallons of 100-octane under the cockpit.
You might have been in for a little ride there. You might have blown a few hundred feet in the sky, huh?
Yeah, we're standing right on the gas tanks.
So when you told your wife that this was dangerous duty, you weren't lying. And there's another story that illustrates that, because you saw firsthand what could happen to a PT boat and its crew if the enemy hit its target. I do want to warn our listeners, this story could get a little graphic.
Every two squadrons have a one tender ship for supplies and ammunition and everything else for us. So there's 24 boats on one tender ship. They're able to lift PT boats up on either side out of the water so they can repair the props and so on. So on this rainy day, low-hanging clouds, our commanders thought that the planes would not be out. But those Japs, they came in, they surprised us, and they got below the clouds. That was a real commotion. We don't know how many planes they had. We had 24 boats, so we had a lot of firepower. See, all of our guns are anti-aircraft. So that was the worst battle and the biggest battle with aircraft that we had. The PT boats were just really saturating the sky, and we were knocking out planes. And, of course, some of the Japs were using bombs on us. I think my boat got probably 5 planes. Finally, they cleared off. We all started back. We got back to where our tenders were. My boat and another boat pulled up to the tender, and we were going to get some gas and so on. One of the few times we were up on the deck of our tender ship, because we lived on the boats, we noticed them pulling in the 524 boat. We had come over together on the same tanker. They pulled in 2 boats, and then the one that had been bombed came in third, and one of the other boats was pulling it on the deck. Why, dead bodies on the 524. The skipper was on the wheel, and then the executive officer was next to him, but he was on the deck in the cockpit. Incidentally, that executive officer had been my executive earlier, but he was on the deck. The skipper was standing up by the wheel. All the rest of the boat, the bodies were down. The 2 bodies on the 40-millimeter in the seats, both of their heads were missing, and the bodies still sitting in their seats. The skipper, he was holding his hand. He had lost all 3 of his fingers. He had his hands on the wheel. And then the executive, Strawn Taylor, he was laying on the deck, and we thought he was gone. After about an hour, he came to. The rest of the boat, the only 2 survivors were Strawn, who was on the floor, and the skipper standing up. The bomb had missed the bow and sprayed the entire length of it and just saturated it. So even the mechanics in the engine room were gone. And then the 2 bodies, That was the worst sight I'd ever seen.
And I'm sure there had to be part of you that, looking at that ship, and you said how close you were with that ship and that crew, that there had to be part of that that said, hey, that could have been our boat. Sorry, I said ship. I know there's a big difference between a ship and a boat, but that could have been our boat.
Yes, that's true. When you see that, well, you think, well, you know, they were your friends. But that's true. It could have been me.
Well, I'm glad it wasn't, and I know all those kids and grandkids and great-grandkids sure are. Time to catch another break. If you hop on hometownheroesradio.com, you're going to find a link to an interesting article about the origins of the insignia for Motor Torpedo Boat Squadron 36, which Gordon was a part of. You'll find some photos of this 94-year-old Navy vet as well, and you'll hear the rest of his story, including the first person to greet him when he came ashore stateside after the war. It's a name I know you're going to recognize, and that's not the biggest surprise in store for us, because it wasn't the biggest surprise waiting for Gordon. He'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.